of Guatemala, however, the civil patrols and ongoing massacres were rarely mentioned. Sources that addressed these matters were ignored, and the overall tone of the news was cautiously hopeful and optimistic. It was the consensus that the 1984 election for a constituent assembly was encouraging and an important first step, and that the 1985 presidential election ended, emphasis added, more than 30 years of military domination. Newsweek, January 17, 1986. Dan Rather on CBS News reported that Cerezo became Guatemala's first civilian leader after 30 years of almost uninterrupted military rule, December 9, 1985. This is ambiguous, but the implication, directly asserted by Newsweek, is that Cerezo, not the army, rules. Julio Méndez Montenegro was a civilian president from 1966 to 1970, but he did not rule, and he was eventually discredited by the fact that he presided over a huge escalation of army violence. Given the earlier experience, the fact that the generals had made it clear that the civilian government was a project of the military, and Cerezo's own expressed reservations about his power, objective news reporting would have been careful about an alleged ending of military rule. As is the case of El Salvador, the murderous rule of the Guatemalan generals did not delegitimize them for the U.S. mass media, nor suggest any possible justice to the rebel cause. Time noted February 27, 1984, that the leftist insurgency poses a permanent challenge to the regime, but it did not inquire into the roots of this insurgency or suggest that its leaders constituted a main opposition whose ability to run would be an acid test of election integrity, as they pronounced in Nicaragua. Time also did not observe that the regime poses a permanent challenge to the survival of its population. The mass murders of the Guatemalan state were even semi-justified by the unquestioned need to quell insurgents. Much of the killing, says Time, is linked to Mejia's success against the insurgents. The phrase "linked to" is an apologetic euphemism to obscure the fact that Mejia's success was based on the mass murder of men, women, and children in literally hundreds of destroyed villages. Mejia has a mixed record, with the mass murder offset by improvements in some important areas, the State Department quoted by Time. Mejia, says Time, won support because he has kept the promises he made after seizing power. Time never explains how it determined that Mejia won support, or from whom, other than the U.S. State Department. Was the press then free to speak out? Did a system of justice come into being? In Chapter 2, we summarized America's Watch's demonstration that the Reagan administration made serial adjustments in its apologetics for each successive Guatemalan terrorist general, with a lagged, tacit acknowledgement that it had previously been lying. This has no influence whatsoever on Time's treatment of State Department pronouncements as authentic truth, the standard from which other claims may be evaluated. Thus, Time says that America's Watch, a controversial group that is often accused of being too sympathetic to the left, called Guatemala a nation of prisoners. Time doesn't independently evaluate the quality of sources. The State Department is unchallenged because it expounds the official and patriotic truth. America's Watch is denigrated and only rarely cited, even with a dismissing put-down, because it challenges official propaganda. Pravda could hardly be more subservient to state demands than Time in its coverage of demonstration elections. The mass media's sourcing on the Guatemalan election was confined almost entirely to U.S. officials and official observers, the most prominent Guatemalan political candidates and generals. Spokespersons for the insurgents, what in Nicaragua would be labeled the main opposition, the smaller parties, spokespersons for popular organizations, the churches, human rights groups, and ordinary citizens were essentially ignored by the media. Time, Newsweek, and CBS News almost never talked to ordinary citizens or spokespersons for the insurgents. Stephen Kinzer in The Times had only one citation to a rebel source in several dozen articles on Guatemala during the election periods, although on election day in 1984 he did speak with a number of ordinary citizens, who gave a much less optimistic view than Kinzer's usual sources. The restricted menu of media sources flows from and reinforces the media's propensity to adopt a patriotic agenda. U.S. government officials and observers are always optimistic and hopeful in their statements about sponsored elections. The leading contestant politicians are also moderately optimistic, as they have a good chance of acquiring at least nominal power. They do, however, express occasional doubts about whether the army will relinquish power. This allows the election drama to assume a slightly different character from that in El Salvador, where it was the Democratic Army protecting the election versus the undemocratic rebels who refused to lay down their arms and participate. In Guatemala, the frame was, will the generals keep their promise to stay in the barracks? The triumph is that they do stay in the barracks. A civilian president takes office and now rules. The media then quickly dropped the subject, so that whether the army really does relinquish power to the civilian leaders is never checked out, just as the peace sought by the populace in El Salvador was never considered in retrospect. In Poland in January 1947, in Nicaragua in 1984, and in enemy states generally, the focus was on the substance of power and the extent to which that power shaped the electoral results in advance, as by limiting the ability of important constituencies to run for office and compete effectively. Not so for Guatemala. If the mass media had enlarged their sources, fundamental conditions would have assumed greater prominence. For example, before both the July 1, 1984 and December 1985 elections in Guatemala, the Guatemala Bishops' Conference issued pastoral statements that suggested in no uncertain terms and with detailed arguments that conditions in the country were incompatible with the free election. Its pastoral letter of June 8, 1984, focused on the civil defense patrols as susceptible to manipulation, and it discussed the disappearances, insatiable corruption, and the fact that socio-political structures are not capable of promoting the welfare of the whole society. Stephen Kinzer mentioned this report in a Times News article of July 22, 1984, but his reference is made after the election of July 1st, and Kinzer did not use it to frame the discussion of electoral conditions and to arrive at an assessment of the quality of the election. Furthermore, his summary of the 27-page report, that it denounced torture, electoral fraud, concentration of wealth, and massacre of entire families, ignores the quite specific critique of the conditions bearing on an election. Time mentioned this pastoral letter briefly. Newsweek and CBS News never mentioned it. In connection with the 1985 election, the bishops put forth another powerful statement, once again questioning whether an election can be meaningful in a situation close to slavery and desperation. They point out that the civil defense patrols, the ideology of national security, and hunger and impoverishment are not conducive to serious elections. In order that the longed-for results be obtained, there must be not only the freedom at the moment of casting one's vote, but also a whole series of particular social, political, and economic conditions which are, unfortunately, not happening in Guatemala. In effect, there still persist in Guatemala harsh violence, lack of respect for human rights, and the breaking of basic laws. It is a fact that any citizen pressured, terrorized, or threatened is not fully able to exercise his or her right to vote or to be elected conscientiously. This letter was not mentioned in the major media or anywhere else, to our knowledge. Although the bishops are conservative, credible, and one of the few organized bodies in Guatemala not crushed by state terror. There were other dissenting voices in Guatemala, politicians of the lesser parties, union officials, human rights groups, lawyers, and jurists, who spoke out occasionally on the limits of free electoral conditions in Guatemala. And there were events of note that threw a powerful light on the subject. Most of these were blacked out in the U.S. mass media. For example, on July 4, 1984, the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission issued a statement in Mexico saying that the election's meaning should be viewed in the context of three important facts, namely, that the requirements for a meaningful election stipulated by the United Nations in a March 14 statement had not been met, that the left had been excluded from participation in the election, and that 115 persons had been murdered or disappeared in the 30 days prior to the election of July 1st. This statement and the facts cited by the commission were ignored in the U.S. press. Consider also the following facts. On May 3rd, General Oscar Mejia Victoris removed Ricardo Sagastume Vidaurre from his position as president of the judiciary and the Supreme Court. On April 11th, the judiciary had issued writs of habeas corpus on behalf of 157 kidnapped individuals, and Sagastume had protested to Mejia Victoris over the difficulty in proceeding against military abuses. On May 4th, Acisco Valladares Molina, head of the Populist Party, noted that Sagastume had been fired like a simple subordinate. On May 8th, a communique from the Guatemalan Bar Association stated that in Guatemala there is no rule of law, as demonstrated by the constant violation of human rights and uncontrolled exercise of arbitrary power. By May 8th, at least 16 judiciary officials, including Supreme Court and Court of Appeals magistrates, had resigned in protest at Sagastume's removal. Stephen Kinzer never discussed any of these events or their meaning in the Times, nor did any of his colleagues elsewhere in the mass media. This is in accord with our hypothesis that in elections held in client states, fundamental electoral conditions, such as the presence or absence of the rule of law, are off the agenda. The point applies to other relevant structural conditions. Thus, while Kinzer occasionally mentioned the civil defense patrols, he never described them and their operations in any detail or tied them in with other institutional structures of control, and he failed to relate them in a systematic way to army power. The numerous reports on these coercive institutions and their terrorist roles by Amnesty International, America's Watch, and the British Parliamentary Human Rights Group were almost never cited by Kinzer in providing facts relevant to the Guatemalan elections. Although the Constituent Assembly elected in 1984 produced a new constitution, Kinzer never once discussed the nature of this instrument, which validated the Special Army role and structural constraints on freedom of the press. Kinzer was reporting news in a way that fit the Times' editorial position and the U.S. government agenda. The Times' editorial frame was that the military, in power for most of 31 years, has honored its promise to permit the free election of a civilian president. Kinzer's news articles in the same period convey the same message. One of them is entitled, "After 30 Years, Democracy Gets a Chance in Guatemala, November 10, 1985, which accurately summarizes the contents, although they contain an undercurrent of reserved final judgment. The central message was false, however. If the basic conditions of a free election were not met, if the army's power remained unimpaired, and if these were confirmed in a written constitution that allows the army freedom from the rule of law and a license to kill without constraint from the nominal democracy." Kinzer could only convey this false message by ignoring the Sagastume case, the institutional arrangements of the counterinsurgency state, the ongoing murders, and the omnipresent fear, that is, the basic conditions of a free election, and by laying stress instead on expressions of hope, orderliness of the election processes, and army promises, that is, the government's propaganda agenda in a demonstration election. In what must be one of the low points of his journalistic career, in an article of December 27, 1985, "Guatemala Vote Heartens Nicaragua Parties," Kinzer even implies that the Guatemala election establishes an electoral model for Nicaragua. He describes a Cerezo visit to Nicaragua, in which Kinzer features the encouragement Cerezo gives to the dissident parties that perhaps the power of the Sandinistas can be broken by patience, implying that Cerezo had broken the power of the army in Guatemala and was in full command. The article closes with a quote from an opposition figure: "Ortega is now the last president in Central America who wears a military uniform, and the contrast is going to be evident." Nowhere in the article does Kinzer point out that army power cannot be read from whether the head of state wears a uniform or that the rule of the army in Guatemala has not yet been overcome. He does not refer to the fact that the Guatemalan army has killed tens of thousands of ordinary civilians, nor does he show any recognition of the fact that the election held in Nicaragua was much more open than that held in Guatemala. On the contrary, this is a fact that the media, including the New York Times, explicitly and consistently deny, in accordance with state imperatives. As in the case of El Salvador, the U.S. mass media never suggested that the exclusion of the Guatemalan insurgent groups rendered the Guatemalan election meaningless. Kinzer several times mentioned with extreme brevity that the left was off the ballot, but he never asked anybody to discuss the meaning of this in terms of the options available to the various segments of society. As co-author of an important book on this topic, Kinzer is well aware of the facts. The vast majority of Guatemalans are very poor, and they have been entirely excluded from political participation or representation since 1954. The insurgency grew out of the parlous condition and exploitation of that mass and the absence of any possibility of a democratic process to alleviate injustice and misery. The ruling army had allowed only parties to run and civilians to hold office who agreed, tacitly or explicitly, to keep off the policy agenda all matters of central concern to the impoverished majority. There is no way to measure the strength of popular support for the insurgents, but in light of the fact that they espouse programs well-oriented to the interests of the general population and have been able to maintain an insurgency without significant external aid, and that the army response has been a war against virtually the entire rural population, the rebel claim to be a main opposition would appear to be stronger than that of Arturo Cruz and his upper-class Nicaraguan associates. And if the rebels, or any candidates who would threaten the army and oligarchy in ways appealing to the majority, cannot qualify in a Guatemalan election, is it not essentially fraudulent? This was strongly suggested in both 1984 and 1985 by the Guatemalan Bishops' Conference, but this respectable source, in contrast with Arturo Cruz and Robert Lakin, is blacked out. As with El Salvador, the election was not evaluated, either in advance or in retrospect, on the basis of whether or not the fundamental requirements of a free election were met. For the U.S. government, the insurgents were not a main opposition. Guatemalan state terror was merely a public relations inconvenience, and the elections were fair. The mass media's treatment of the Guatemalan election reflected well this government propaganda agenda. 3.6. Nicaragua. Media service in the delegitimizing process. In contrast with the Salvadoran and Guatemalan cases, the Reagan administration was intent on discrediting the Nicaraguan election, which threatened to legitimize the Sandinista government and thus weaken the case for U.S. funding of a terrorist army. The administration had been berating the Sandinistas for failing to hold an election, but the actual holding of one was inconvenient. From the inception of Nicaraguan planning for the election, therefore, the administration began to express doubts about its quality. And just as it devoted itself to creating a positive image of the two client state elections, so it extended substantial resources to depict the Nicaraguan election in the worst possible light. The media dutifully followed course, as a propaganda model predicts. The mass media failed to call attention to the cynicism of first assailing Nicaragua for failing to hold an election and then striving to have the election either postponed or discredited. Time even cites the absence of official delegations of observers from the major Western democracies, November 19, 1984, as if this were evidence of something discreditable in the election rather than as a reflection of U.S. power. There were 450-odd foreign observers in attendance at the Nicaraguan election, some with superb credentials, observing more freely and at a greater length than the official U.S. observers in El Salvador and Guatemala. Time and the rest of the mass media paid no attention to them. Stephen Kinzer's use of observers is noteworthy. In the case of Nicaragua, he completely ignored the unofficial observers, many exceedingly well qualified to observe, as we have noted, and he even ignored the official Dutch government team, drawn from the center-right and highly apologetic about atrocities in El Salvador, which observed both the Salvadoran and the Nicaraguan elections and concluded that the elections in Nicaragua were more open than in El Salvador in the sense that more people were able to take part, that the opposition did not fear for their lives, and that the legitimation of the regime is thus confirmed. In Guatemala, by contrast, he cited the official observer report in both the 1984 and 1985 elections, despite their great bias and superficiality. In the 1984 Guatemala election, Kinzer did refer to the report of an unofficial human rights law group that we cited earlier, quoting their statement that the voting process was procedurally correct, but neglecting to note here and elsewhere their numerous statements to the effect that the greater part of the population lives in permanent fear, so that procedural correctness has little meaning. With no U.S. government-designated official observers available in Nicaragua, the media relied even more heavily than usual on U.S. government handouts. It is enlightening to compare this conduited propaganda of the mass media with the findings of foreign observer teams on the scene in Nicaragua. For the purpose of this comparison, which follows, we will use two such reports. One, that of the Irish Interparty Parliamentary Delegation, is the Elections in Nicaragua, November 1984. The delegation was composed of four individuals, three from right-wing or moderate-right political parties who spent 17 days in Nicaragua at the time of the election. We will also use as a bias of comparison of media coverage the previously cited report of the 15-member delegation sent by the Latin American Studies Association, LASA, half of whom had substantial field experience in Nicaragua itself. This delegation spent 8 days in Nicaragua before the election, traveled in a rented bus, determined their own itinerary, and spoke with anyone we chose to approach, as well as numerous people who spontaneously approached us. 3.6.1. Tone of negativism and apathy. Time magazine hardly attempts to hide the fact that it takes its cues from Washington. It quotes John Hughes, then a public relations man for the State Department, and previously and subsequently a columnist for the Christian Science Monitor. It was not a very good election. It was just a piece of theater for the Sandinistas. Time follows this cue with a series of denigrating strokes. The Sandinistas win, as expected. The Nicaraguan election mood was one of indifference. The outcome was never in doubt. Something of an anticlimax. All in the issue of November 19, 1984. In an earlier article, October 29th, Time indulged in the same negative refrain. A campaign without suspense, voters too apathetic to go to the polls at all. This was a forecast dredged up well before the election. In both articles, fear was also featured heavily. In the Salvadoran election, Time's tone was different. There was no denying the remarkable sense of occasion, meaning the Reagan administration had a big public relations investment in the election. Hundreds of thousands braved the threats and sometimes the bullets of the Marxist-led FMLN to join long serpentine polling lines for the country's much-awaited presidential elections. April 9, 1984. In Guatemala, too. Some 1.8 million voters braved four-hour polling lines, tropical rainstorms, and a bewildering array of political choices to cast ballots in their country's most open and fraud-free elections in more than a decade. July 16, 1984. There is never apathy or fear of government force in Time's renditions of demonstration elections. Stephen Kirzner in the Times also took a far less kindly view of the election in Nicaragua than those in Guatemala, giving enormous attention to election opponents like the U.S. candidate Arturo Cruz, whereas in Guatemala he almost completely ignored the small parties, union protesters, rebels, and human rights groups, and finding more people voting out of fear than he did in Guatemala, a remarkable discovery given the circumstances in the two countries. He focuses steadily on the Sandinistas' efforts to get out the vote, the fact that the election result is a foregone conclusion, claims of the breaking up of election rallies, and allegations of unfairness and withdrawals by the opposition. As with Time, the voters are philosophical. Enthusiasm for the election was not universal, and there was little visible enthusiasm. Kinzer did not compare the electoral modalities, range of options, or other basic conditions in Nicaragua and Guatemala or El Salvador. In short, he discussed different questions in his news reporting on the elections in Nicaragua and Guatemala, adhering closely to the propaganda frame. On the alleged negativism and apathy, both the Irish and LASA delegations noted that voting was not required in Nicaragua and was entirely secret. Therefore, as the Irish delegation pointed out, the low rate of abstention is more meaningful and invalidates predictions that large sectors of the population were opposed to the election. Furthermore, the percentage of spoiled votes, 7.4%, is comparable to any European election in a country with a highly literate population. They also note that, speaking with one old man awaiting his turn to vote in a rural polling station, one member of the delegation inquired, "What difference do you see between this and any other election in which you voted?" He replied, "Everything." "In what way?" He simply shrugged. "Everything is different." The U.S. media never located anybody like this old man. The Irish delegation also pointed out that some observers from other countries suggested that the people did not appear enthusiastic as they went to the polls. This is not surprising, as people stood in long queues waiting patiently their turn to go behind the curtain to mark their ballot paper. One member of the delegation, who had the opportunity to observe voters in the American election just 2 days later, noted no greater enthusiasm for standing in queues there. It is our belief that the invariable enthusiasm and optimism found by the U.S. mass media in client state elections and the apathy and negativism found in elections in states disfavored by the U.S. administration has nothing to do with electoral realities and must be explained entirely by an imposed propaganda agenda and the filtering out of contrary opinion and information. 3.6.2 Ignoring the superior quality of the Nicaraguan election. In the propaganda format, a great deal of attention is paid to the mechanical properties of elections in client states, but not in states whose elections are being denigrated. This was true in the cases under discussion. Time, April 9, 1984, described in detail the elaborate electoral preparations in El Salvador, the tamper-proof procedures, the use of transparent Lucite ballot boxes, and the indelible ink marking and stamping of ID cards. It turned out, however, that the high-tech computerized voting procedures weren't understood by the population, more than half of whom were illiterate. At no point did Time or its media colleagues raise any question about the importance of improving literacy as a necessary prelude to an election. Nor did they suggest that the Lucite boxes might compromise the secrecy of the vote, or that the stamped ID card might be a coercive instrument helping to explain turnout. Nicaragua went to great pains to provide for election secrecy and for an easy and intelligible system of voting. For one thing, they had a massive literacy campaign before the election, making electoral printed matter generally accessible. Both the Irish and Lhasa delegations mentioned that this is an electoral plus. Nicaragua also put a high priority on getting a complete registration list and getting the voters registered. The Irish delegation noted that recent elections in other Central American countries, such as El Salvador and Guatemala, did not introduce such measures, and there was considerable debate concerning the validity of their registers, which were based on out-of-date census figures, incomplete official registers of population changes, and other sources. Nicaragua also deliberately avoided transparent ballot boxes, ID stamping, and any other mechanism that would allow the authorities to identify whether or how somebody had voted. Lhasa points out that the ballots were also printed on heavy opaque white paper. The contrast with Somoza-era elections is striking. The Somozas used translucent ballots, so virtually everyone assumed that their ballot was not secret. The same problem occurred in the 1984 elections in El Salvador, where thin paper ballots were deposited in transparent ballot boxes. The vote in Nicaragua in 1984 was truly a secret ballot. In Nicaragua also, there was proportional voting, which made it possible for the smaller parties to obtain legislative representation. Parties could also qualify quite easily to participate in the election. In Guatemala, 4,000 signatures were needed to qualify in 1984, a large number and not easy for dissident parties to collect in a society with daily political murders. Stephen Kinzer and his associates never mentioned these differences. More generally, the substantial merits of the Nicaraguan elections were never contrasted with the procedure in the U.S. client states, a comparison that would have been most revealing and that would have thoroughly undermined the Reagan agenda to which the media were committed in their reporting of the election. Time, as noted, mentions the compromised Salvadoran procedures as if they were meritorious. The Times mentioned the transparent voting boxes in El Salvador only once, Richard Meislin on March 25, 1984, repeating without question the official line that the purpose of the translucent boxes was to prevent fraud. Any other possibility is unmentioned. Newsweek and CBS ignored these matters. 3.6.3 Rebel disruption into the black hole. Turnout no longer an index of triumph of democracy. In the Salvadoran election, rebel disruption was a central feature of the government's propaganda frame. Because the rebels opposed the election, voting by the people proved their rejection of the rebels and approval of the army. Turnout was the index of democratic triumph and rebel defeat. As we saw, the mass media followed this frame without question. In the case of Nicaragua, the propaganda format was reversed. The rebels were the good guys, and the election held by the bad guys was condemned in advance. Rebel opposition to the election and efforts at disruption did not make voting and a large turnout a repudiation of the rebels and approval of the Sandinistas. The U.S. mass media once again followed the government agenda, even though it meant an exact reversal of the standards they had applied in the Salvadoran election. The Contras and their supporters urged the public not to vote and interfered with the election process with at least as much vigor as, and with more killings than, the rebels in El Salvador. Furthermore, voting was more assuredly secret, and the citizens were not required to vote or to have ID cards stamped indicating that they had. And the Sandinistas did not kill ordinary citizens on a daily basis, as was true in the death squad democracies. Thus, turnout was far more meaningful in the Nicaraguan election than in the ones held in El Salvador and Guatemala. The public was free to abstain as well as to vote for opposition parties. The U.S. mass media disposed of this problem mainly by massive suppression. They simply ignored the Contra U.S. campaign for abstention, waged with threats and attacks on polling places and election workers, and they buried the fact of an effectively secret vote and the right not to vote, just as, in parallel, they had inflated the rebel disruption efforts in El Salvador in 1982 and 1984 and buried the voting requirement and other pressures to vote. Although the New York Times had gone out of its way to focus on the challenge of rebel opposition and alleged disruption as giving turnout special meaning in the Salvadoran election of 1982, Stephen Kinzer never once mentioned that the Contras attacked a number of polling stations and had issued radio appeals for abstention. For Kinzer, neither these facts nor the U.S. campaign to discredit were seen as posing a challenge that made turnout meaningful in Nicaragua. The Irish delegation pointed out that the parties of the Democratic Coordinating Committee, based in the business community, opposed the voter registration and called for a boycott of this process. And it noted that 11 polling stations were closed down by counter-revolutionary activities. The public voted in large numbers despite the possible dangers involved, which suggested to the Irish delegation that turnout was significant and showed how important the election was to the people. Lassa pointed out the various ways in which the main opposition called for voter abstention and cited the radio warnings broadcast into the country from Costa Rica threatening that voters would be killed by the Contras. Lassa also pointed out that voter turnout was heavy, with more enthusiasm among voters in low-income areas than in more affluent neighborhoods. Like Time, Lassa notes that the turnout did not quite realize the expectations of FSLN officials. But unlike Time, Lassa points out that the rate of participation achieved compares very favorably with the rates achieved in 11 other recent Latin American elections, as well as the 1984 U.S. presidential election. In sum, the two Observer reports discuss rebel disruption in Nicaragua, turnout, and the meaning of that turnout. The U.S. mass media, which had featured these matters heavily in reference to the Salvadoran election, where they fitted the government's propaganda agenda, found them entirely unnewsworthy as regards Nicaragua. 3.6.4 The Revived Sensitivity to Coercion. As we described earlier, the coercion package was off the agenda for the U.S. government and mass media in addressing the Salvadoran and Guatemalan elections. So was the element of fear engendered by mass murder and the absence of any rule of law in these U.S. client states. Coercion and fear were back on the agenda, however, for Nicaragua. This revival was illustrated with amazing dishonesty and hypocrisy in Time, which had never mentioned fear and pressures from the government as factors possibly explaining turnout in the U.S.-sponsored elections, even after the murder of 50,000 civilians. In Nicaragua, however, the pugnacious Sandinistas had an awesome monopoly of force, and getting them to relax their grip, which was essential for free electoral competition, was extremely dubious. Times Central American correspondent George Russell even located a Latin American diplomat who says, "You can't have democracy where there is no personal liberty at all." October 8th and May 14th, 1984. Russell and Time had never found the Salvadoran government pugnacious, with any awesome monopoly of force, or as having a grip that needed relaxing for electoral competition, and personal liberty was never mentioned as lacking or even pertinent to Salvadoran elections. For the Nicaraguan election, however, Time found that the pressure to participate was high. Many citizens feared they would lose precious rationing cards. Further, the government had made it clear that it considered failure to vote a counter-revolutionary stance. Later, quoting Daniel Ortega, "All Nicaraguans who are Nicaraguans are going to vote. The only ones who are not going to vote are sellouts." November 19, 1984. As we pointed out earlier, both the Guatemalan and Salvadoran army warned the public that voting was required by law and that non-voting was treasonous. These statements were more precisely warnings, whereas Ortega's was an insult, but not a clear threat. Ortega's was the only such statement of its kind reported, and Time's statement that the government made it clear that non-voting was counter-revolutionary is doubly dishonest. The statement was not clearly a warning, and counter-revolutionary is an invidious word concocted by Time. The official government position, as expressed in the law, was that Nicaraguans did not have to vote. Time suppresses this fact. It suppresses the secrecy of the ballot and absence of a checkable ID card, so that there would have been no way to implement a threat, even if one had been made. It suppresses the fact that the Nicaraguan army did not regularly murder even counter-revolutionaries, whereas the Salvadoran and Guatemalan armies murdered numerous people who weren't revolutionaries, but were somehow in the way. In short, propaganda could hardly be more brazen. Time's alleged fact that many people feared the removal of the rationing card is contested by LASA, which states that in our interviews in many neighborhoods in several cities, we found no evidence that ration cards were being held back or withdrawn for any reason. They note that there were 5 reports filed with the Supreme Electoral Council alleging intimidation by threat of withdrawal of ration cards, but none of these allegations were sustained upon investigation. Time does not indicate the source of its evidence and fails to provide a single illustration of the many cases. We noted earlier that Stephen Kinzer cited more claims of coercion in the Nicaraguan than the Guatemalan elections, a remarkable journalistic achievement given the unchallenged facts about the actual scale and character of repression in the two states. His playing down of state terror in Guatemala as a basic factor affecting the quality of the election in all its dimensions, the ability of candidates to run, freedom of speech and press, the existence of intermediate groups, endemic fear, and the meaning of turnout, amounts to a massive deceit. His Nicaraguan coverage also involved large-scale misrepresentation. He did not point out the absence of mass killings, and he failed to mention the absence of a coercion package. No transparent boxes, no requirement that an ID card be stamped, and no legal obligation to vote. Kinzer's one notice of the voting requirement in his 14 articles on the election amounts to serious deception. He quotes a voter as follows, "I've always voted because it's always required," he said. Of course, the law says one thing, but after a while, one realizes that voting is a part of patriotism, and patriotism leads to a long life. Kinzer's source implies, but doesn't say directly, that voting is not legally required in Nicaragua. And this murky statement, the closest Kinzer ever comes to acknowledging the absence of a voting requirement, is counterbalanced by his respondent's suggestion that voting may be based on some kind of threat. Both the Irish and LASA delegations stressed the superior protection of secrecy in the balloting, which, in LASA's words, was meticulously designed to minimize the potential for abuses. They also emphasized the fact that voting was not required by law and that, contrary to the U.S. government propaganda expounded by Time and other media entities, the coercive elements in getting out the vote were small. Human rights abuses by the government that contribute to an environment of fear, Lassa pointed out, were on a very small scale when compared to other nations in the region. In fact, they note that fear in Nicaragua is directed more to the United States and the Contras than to the government in Managua. 3.6.5, the main opposition to the four. As we heard in El Salvador and Guatemala, the fact that the insurgents were off the ballot did not faze the U.S. media one bit. Neither did Duarte's acknowledgement in 1981 that the masses were with the guerrillas when he joined the junta a year earlier, which would clearly make them a main opposition. Nor were the media affected by the army's murder of the opposition leadership in both El Salvador and Guatemala. In El Salvador, the exclusion of the rebels was part of the U.S. government's electoral plan. They were, therefore, not a main opposition, and the debarment and even murder of their leaders did not compromise election quality. In the Nicaraguan case, in sharp contrast, the U.S. government worked with a different frame. The exclusion of its sponsored rebels and any other candidates was a serious matter that threatened the quality of the election. The media followed like good little doggies, lap rather than watch. The central dramatic propaganda line for the Nicaraguan election pressed by U.S. officials was the alleged struggle of Arturo Cruz to induce the Sandinistas to create an open system in which he would be able to compete fairly, the failure of the Marxist-Leninists to make adequate concessions, Cruz's refusal to compete, and the subsequent exclusion of the main opposition. Cruz, however, was a main opposition only in the propaganda construct of the U.S. government and mass media. A longtime expatriate, who now concedes that he was on the CIA payroll with no mass base in Nicaragua, Cruz would almost certainly have done poorly in a free election. There is good reason to believe that Cruz never intended to run, but that he and his sponsors had held out this possibility precisely to allow the propaganda frame to be used effectively. The mass media focused on the Cruz drama heavily and uncritically. Cruz was given enormous play. He was continually referred to as the main opposition or leading opponent of the ruling party, without any supporting evidence. And his candidacy was made an acid test of the Sandinistas' democratic intentions. Time, October 29, 1984. For the Times, the election would be a sham without Cruz. Editorial, October 7, 1984. And its news columns placed main opposition Cruz on center stage, from which vantage point he could regularly denounce the proceedings as a farce or sham. The Times did have one good back-page article that provided evidence that Cruz had not intended to run or would not have been allowed to run by his closest Nicaraguan allies and U.S. officials, and that his function was, as we stated, to discredit the election by pretending to be interested, thus capturing press attention. But this low-keyed article stood alone and did not alter the unremitting focus on the alleged exclusion of this alleged main opposition as the centerpiece of the Nicaraguan election drama. In focusing on an alleged main opposition in Nicaragua, which voluntarily chose not to run, while ignoring a real main opposition in El Salvador, excluded by force and plan, the mass media simply adopted without question the government's propaganda framework. Sources that would speak to the condition of the main opposition in El Salvador and the significance of its exclusion, both Salvadorans and foreign observers, were simply ignored. In the case of the Nicaraguan election, in contrast, Cruz and U.S. government officials were given the floor to present their themes, which were transmitted on a daily basis with no accompanying notice of their possible falsity and manipulative intent, in perfect accord with the expectations of a propaganda model. The Reagan administration not only dangled Cruz before the media, it tried hard to induce or bribe other candidates in the Nicaraguan election to withdraw in order to fulfill the prophecy of a meaningless election. The brazenness of this intervention by a great power was remarkable, but the U.S. media gave it minimal attention. They never denounced it as anti-democratic. They failed to link it to Cruz's campaign with its suggestion of a larger effort to discredit by boycott, and they never suggested that voter turnout was more meaningful given the active U.S. campaign to discredit the election. On October 31, 1984, Stephen Kinzer noted that senior U.S. officials confirmed accounts of regular contacts with the Nicaraguan parties. Kinzer's article is headlined, "Nicaraguan Parties Cite Sandinista and U.S. Pressure," the headline and article itself equating the government's aid to and agreements with its own political parties with U.S. intervention to get the Nicaraguan parties to boycott the election. CBS, Newsweek, and Time ignored the U.S. bribe program entirely. Time gave great emphasis to the number of candidates and the withdrawal of several, but it never once mentioned that this was helped along by U.S. connivance, bribes, and pressure. It even quotes without comment the State Department fabrication that it did not try to influence the outcome of the election, November 19, 1984. All substantive evidence is placed in the black hole. In the same article, Time asserts that the U.S. had pushed hard for elections in which all parties felt free to participate, a fabrication of considerable audacity. As regards the scope of electoral options in Nicaragua, the Irish delegation noted that the political parties law guarantees participation to political parties of all ideologies, an interesting point validated by a range of political opinion in the contesting parties far wider than found in El Salvador and Guatemala, or the United States. Lassa states that no major political tendency in Nicaragua was denied access to the electoral process in 1984. This, of course, could not be said of El Salvador and Guatemala. These important features of the Nicaraguan law and practice were not mentioned in the U.S. media or compared with those of the client states. The Irish delegation stressed two facts about Cruz as the main opposition. First, the delegation found no evidence that these parties, the three small Cruz-related parties that boycotted the election, had wide support within the country. Speaking with many political figures, including representatives of the legitimate opposition parties, it became clear that the intention of Arturo Cruz to stand for election was dubious from the start. While considerable coverage was given to these parties in the international press, members of the delegation found that their impact among the population was scant and few people supported their policies. Second, the Irish delegation stressed the fact that the populace was free not to vote or spoil votes, and the low level of both, despite the abstentionism promoted by the Cruz parties, deflated their claims to any serious support. The Lassa report reached similar conclusions based on an extensive review of the evidence, namely, 1, that circumstantial evidence indicates the strong probability that Cruz had no intention of running, and 2, that he had no mass base and would have been badly beaten. In retrospect, Kinzer concedes the fact, although with the customary propaganda twist. He writes that Ortega's landslide victory was never in doubt because the opposition was splintered and, as he fails to observe, had no popular base in contrast to the well-organized Sandinista Party, and because the Sandinistas controlled the electoral machinery. Neither he nor anyone else has offered a particle of evidence that Sandinista control over the electoral machinery made the elections a sham, or to contest the conclusion of the Lassa delegation that the FSLN did little more to take advantage of its incumbency than incumbent parties everywhere, including the United States, routinely do. A few days earlier, Kinzer had quoted Arturo Cruz as observing that the Sandinistas deserve credit for having overthrown Somoza and having broken barriers in Nicaragua that had to be broken, and that is irreversible, because the Sandinistas were working in the catacombs while we in the traditional opposition were out of touch with the rising expectation of the masses. As Kinzer knows, but will not write, the same was true at the time of the 1984 elections, which is why the Sandinista victory was never in doubt. This deceitful dismissal of the 1984 elections is one of Kinzer's many contributions to the media campaign to contrast the elected presidents of the four Central American democracies with the Sandinista dictator Ortega, not an elected president by U.S. government imprimatur. The specific context was the massive media campaign to attribute the failures of the Guatemala City Peace Agreement of August 1987 to the Sandinistas, in accordance with Reagan administration priorities on the eve of the crucial congressional vote on renewed Contra aid. Lassa also stresses the fact that Cruz, effectively representing the Contras, a segment of the local business community and the United States, could have run in the Nicaraguan election with excellent funding, ample media access, and without fear of being murdered. Even without Cruz, the Contras had an electoral voice. Lassa notes that we know of no election in Latin America or elsewhere in which groups advocating the violent overthrow of an incumbent government have themselves been incorporated into the electoral process, particularly when these groups have been openly supported by a foreign power. The Contras, nevertheless, had a voice in the 1984 election campaign. Two of the Coordinadora-affiliated parties, the PSD and the PLC, supported their inclusion in the elections, and while denying that they represented the Contras, Arturo Cruz and the Coordinadora seemed to endorse and promote their cause, both within Nicaragua and abroad. Lassa also discusses in some detail the U.S. intervention in the election, noting the terrorizing overflights by U.S. planes during the election campaign, and considering at some length the U.S. efforts to induce the withdrawal of candidates. Lassa reported the claims by both liberal and conservative party figures that the United States offered specific and large sums of money to get candidates to withdraw from the election. 3.6.6. The concern over freedom of the press and assembly. Not only the rights of any and all candidates to run for public office, but other basic conditions that had been off the agenda in El Salvador and Guatemala were of deep concern to the U.S. government and mass media in reference to Nicaragua. The New York Times, Time, Newsweek, and CBS News all put great stress on the trials and tribulations of La Prensa, although during the Salvadoran election, none of them had even mentioned the destruction by physical violence and murder of La Crónica and El Independiente, or the toll of murdered journalists. Mob violence allegedly organized by the government and the threat of the neighborhood defense committees were featured by Time in Nicaragua, whereas Orden and the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala it had never mentioned as pertinent to election quality. Basic conditions of a free election were not only back on the media agenda, but there were strong suggestions that Nicaragua was failing to meet these conditions. These suggestions were based almost entirely on quotes from U.S. officials and Cruz and his allies in Nicaragua. The media never gave evidence of actually having looked into these matters for themselves or tapped independent sources of evidence. Richard Wagner on CBS News, November 3, 1984, citing as usual Arturo Cruz as the strongest opposition, also mobilizes a single Nicaraguan citizen, no doubt selected at random, who says, "How can this be free elections when we don't have freedom of speech, freedom of the press?" Wagner says that, in addition to censorship, there were food shortages, a deteriorated transportation system, an unpopular draft, and church opposition, so that it becomes apparent why a free and open election is not in the cards. The cynicism in failing to raise the question of why there are food shortages and a deteriorated transportation system in Nicaragua is remarkable. Wagner also misses another distinction between Nicaragua and El Salvador. The former has an unpopular draft, whereas in the terror state of El Salvador, there is no draft. Instead, there is press ganging of young men into the army from the slums, refugee camps, and rural areas, while the young sons of the wealthy live the high life in San Salvador and Miami. Much the same is true in Guatemala and Honduras. Wagner's double standard is also remarkable. In El Salvador in 1982 and 1984, there was far more severe censorship, including outright murder, food shortages, a deteriorating transportation system, and church opposition, and more pertinent, a complete exclusion of the main opposition and massive state terror. But these didn't make it apparent to CBS News that a free and open election was not in the cards in that U.S.-sponsored election. The Irish delegation and Lassa, especially the latter, addressed these issues, gave evidence of having examined them seriously, and came up with conclusions sharply at odds with the U.S. government media portrayals. Lassa provided an extensive discussion of the Sandinista Defense Committee and the scope of the Turba violence and interference with freedom of assembly, concluding that the total number of disruptive incidents reported was quite small, and that the most serious occurred before the official campaign began. In spite of Daniel Ortega's unfortunate statement on these disruptions, there is no evidence that the FSLN had a coherent strategy of stimulating or orchestrating them. As regards the defense committees, Lassa concluded that they did not seem to be functioning as a spying network and that there was no serious evidence that they were a force making for intimidation. Lassa makes two additional points ignored by the free press. One is that the Electoral Commission placed paid advertisements in the press urging citizens to respect the rights of all political parties to hold rallies without interference. The second is that the Cruz rallies that were disrupted were held in violation of the electoral law, which requires permits for campaign rallies and promises police protection. In other words, given their decision not to register, Cruz and the Coordinadora were deliberately campaigning outside of the legal framework of protections which had been created by the electoral law. Lassa also compares the violence in the Nicaraguan election with that elsewhere in the area, and in the Nicaraguan context, concluding that, compared to other nations in the region and in the face of a war against the Contras, such abuses are on a very small scale. Lassa also discussed freedom of the press, which it regards as one of the election's most troublesome features. It considers the imposition of press censorship to have been damaging to the election's quality and credibility, even though the argument of the Sandinistas that a country at war can't allow a newspaper which is the instrument of the enemy to publish its opinions freely, Sergio Ramirez, is viewed as not wholly unreasonable. Nevertheless, while the censorship was also somewhat arbitrary and legalistic, Lassa concluded that the opposition could and did get its message out. And the finding overall was that the Nicaraguan election, by Latin American standards, was a model of probity and fairness. The U.S. mass media did not concur, but it is striking how they avoid comparisons and data. The way in which the media can denounce restrictions on freedom of the press in Nicaragua after having totally ignored the question in El Salvador, where restrictions were far more severe, is remarkable. This process of dichotomization is so internalized that the writers used the double standard within the same article, apparently unaware of their own bias. In an article in the New York Times of March 12, 1984, Clear Choices in Salvador, Murky Plans in Nicaragua, Hedrick Smith regards the choices as clear in El Salvador, whereas in Nicaragua the problem is whether in an election the Sandinistas will give up significant power and control. Multiple parties from the far right to the center right in El Salvador demonstrate clear choices, but a variety of parties from right to far left in Nicaragua didn't cause Smith to perceive real choices there, although he didn't explain why. It apparently never occurs to Smith that there is an issue of whether the Army and United States will give up power and control and their determination to fight to victory by the electoral route in El Salvador. Are there essential freedoms and absence of coercion in El Salvador that are necessary for a truly free election? Hedrick Smith talks about substantive electoral conditions only in Nicaragua. He provides extensive detail on the trials of La Prensa, press censorship, the Sandinista monopoly of power, and limits allegedly imposed on opposition candidates in Nicaragua. Not a word, however, on death squad and army murders of civilians in El Salvador or the draconian laws of the state of siege. How many journalists have been killed in El Salvador? Papers closed, radio stations blown up, union leaders and political figures murdered. These questions are off the agenda in U.S. staged elections, and Hedrick Smith ignores them. As a de facto spokesman for his government, the Times commentator uses doublethink with as much insouciance as Reagan and Schultz. 3.7. Quantitative evidence of systematic media bias. To demonstrate more rigorously the structural bias in media coverage of third world elections, compare the topics mentioned in the New York Times in its articles on the Nicaraguan and Salvadoran elections of 1984. Our hypothesis is that the media will follow the agenda, stressing personalities and other elements in sponsored elections and playing down basic conditions, whereas in elections like that in Nicaragua, the agenda will be reversed. The stress will be placed on basic conditions. It can readily be determined that in the Salvadoran election, the Times' news coverage dealt heavily with subjects like rebel disruption, political infighting, and neglected the basic conditions that make an election meaningful in advance. We can observe how the Times totally ignores the question of freedom of the press, organizational freedom, and limits on the ability of candidates to run. This is similar to how the Times treated the forthcoming Nicaraguan election in the same two-month period. It is evident that the paper focuses heavily on the fundamental conditions of a free election, meaning on topics that it was entirely ignoring while addressing the Salvadoran election. Consider the breakdown of topics covered by the Times during the Nicaraguan election later in the year. Again, although the differences are less marked than before, the substantial attention to basic conditions in the Nicaraguan case is clear, reflecting editorial news choices that follow a patriotic agenda. As the basic conditions for a free election were superior in Nicaragua and the coercive elements less acute, the emphasis on basic conditions only in the Nicaraguan case is even more clearly evidence of systematic bias. 3.8. The MIG crisis staged during Nicaragua's election week. As Newsweek pointed out on November 19, 1984, the story of the freighter to Nicaragua allegedly carrying MIGs first broke during the election night coverage. But at no point does Newsweek or Time, The Times, or CBS News suggest that the timing was deliberate. The Times, in its extensive coverage of the MIGs that weren't there, at one point quotes a Nicaraguan official who suggests that the crisis was purely a public relations operation. But that exhausts the Times' exploration of this point. Although the MIGs weren't there, and the timing was perfect for diverting attention from a successful election that the Reagan administration had been attempting to discredit, the elite media asked no questions, even in retrospect. The administration claimed that when the freighter was loaded, satellite observation was blocked so that the cargo was unknown. The mass media presented this as fact, making no effort to evaluate the claim. What the media chose to focus on was administration assessments of what it might do if MIGs were in fact being delivered. This allowed the whole frame of discourse to shift to the assumption that the Nicaraguans had done something, and something intolerable to boot. Newsweek, in a retrospective article entitled, "The MIGs That Weren't There," had a lead head. "To bring in high-performance craft indicates that they are contemplating being a threat to their neighbors." The fact that the MIGs weren't brought in, as stated in the article's very title, that this was a concoction of U.S. officials, doesn't interfere with imputing an intention to the Nicaraguans based on a non-existent fact. The assertion that they were contemplating being a threat, as opposed to defending themselves against a proxy invasion, is also a patriotic editorial judgment. Newsweek also says in the text that all sides appear to be playing a very clumsy and very dangerous game. This is an intriguing form of even-handedness. A person who admittedly had been falsely accused of robbery by an assailant is alleged to be playing a dangerous game, along with the attacker, who was also the bearer of false witness. In the middle of an article on the Nicaraguan election, Time inserts the government claim that a ship carrying crates of the type used to transport MiG-21s was due at a Nicaraguan port. Time never questions a government propaganda ploy, no matter how blatant, and it offers a retrospective only when the government tacitly concedes it had deliberately deceived. Like Newsweek and The Times, Time allowed the government to set the agenda with a public relations statement. If the Nicaraguans did this, it would be a challenge to the United States. How then would we react? What are our policy options, etc.? The truth of the claim and the likelihood that this is a manipulative ploy to help remove the unwanted elections from attention are not discussed, and naturally, the fact that this is part of a policy of aggression against a tiny victim is never raised. The only credits in the media coverage of the MIG crisis go to CBS News. On November 6th, Dan Rather gave the Strait Administration news that MIGs might be on their way and that a strategic option to destroy them was under consideration. On November 7th and 8th, however, perhaps out of a recognition that it had once again been used, CBS gave substantial coverage to Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Miguel Descoto's rebuttal, which allowed him to point out the absurdity of the Nicaraguan threat, the tie-in of the MIG claims to the Nicaraguan election, and the U.S. refusal to go along with the Contadora peace proposals. The MIG ploy was nevertheless entirely successful. A tone of crisis was manufactured, and options against the hypothetical Sandinista threat were placed at the center of public attention. The Nicaraguan election was not discussed. Lassa points out that the final results of Nicaragua's election were not even reported by most of the international media. They were literally buried under an avalanche of alarmist news reports. Lassa concludes that the Nicaraguan electoral process was manipulated, as the U.S. government claims, but by the U.S. government itself in its effort to discredit an election that it did not want to take place. The Salvadoran and Guatemalan elections successfully legitimized the U.S.-backed regimes, at least for American elite opinion. The far more honest Nicaraguan election failed to accomplish this, thanks to the loyal service of the media. 3.9. The role of official observers in reinforcing a propaganda line. Official observers provide a perfect example of the use of government-controlled experts and pseudo-events to attract media attention and channel it in the direction of the propaganda line. And they regularly succeed in doing this in demonstration elections, no matter how brief their stay and foolish their comments. The media take it for granted that official observers are newsworthy. They are notables. Their selection by the government from reputable institutions adds to their credibility, and their observations will have effects on opinion and policy. This rationale is in the nature of a self-fulfilling prophecy. They have effects only because the media accord them attention. As the official observers reliably commend the elections as fair without the slightest attention to basic conditions, the media's regular use of these observers for comments on